After Party Pod is brought to you by the book Ending Addiction for Good, which is by Cliffside Treatment Center founder and CEO Richard Tate and Dr. Constance Scharf, Cliffside's addiction researcher. Through self-disclosure, case studies, scientific facts, and firsthand experience, Tate and Scharf explain how anyone can recover from addiction. I'm a big fan of the book. I'm not the only one. It's received rave reviews, and it also made it into the VMA's gift bag, and you just know those people need to hear this message. You can get the book by going to Amazon, or you can go to Cliffside's website, which is cliffsidemalibu.com. Get the book. Get it now. I recommend it. Hi, guys. Anna David here with After Party Pod. And a special, special treat for you today. I'm not talking about that amazing theme song by Seth Rothschild. I'm not. I mean, that is special. But my guest today, the lovely and hilarious Danielle Stewart, is a comedian. And she has appeared on E! And VH1 and TBS and Howard TV and Playboy TV. And just to round things out, the Disney Channel. She's contributed to Life and Style magazine and Girls Gone Wild magazine, because apparently that is a magazine. And she tours all over. She's been to Denmark. She's been to Jamaica. She's even been to exotic Des Moines. She's been at the Boston Comedy Festival, the Detroit Comedy Festival, a whole lot of comedy festivals. And she's been featured on Hulu's Comedy Brew and Ladies Night Out. Now, this is a woman who is not afraid to say pretty much anything. I met her and I thought instantly, she's so funny. She's so naturally funny, not trying to be funny, just naturally funny. And I want her on my podcast. And so I pursued that, and I was able to secure that for you guys. I did it for you guys. And what I loved about it was not just that we sat in her bedroom, on her bed, if you must know the truth, but that's because there was a crew of men cutting down trees and outside her apartment, and there was literally a man swinging a sword in the street when I walked up, and we were afraid of the noise, not the danger, because we're not afraid of stuff like that, but the noise. And so yes, we went to the quiet bedroom and had a very frank conversation about sobriety. She's been sober nearly a decade. She talked a lot about that, and we really got into the topic of sex addiction and sexual obsession, and we discussed also sort of jealousy and envy and hope and Facebook and Twitter. And I mean, honestly, am I not listing some compelling topics? So I really had a great time, and I think you guys will too. So please welcome and enjoy the lovely Danielle Stewart. Okay, so Danielle, we're recording.
Awesome.
Well, we're sort of, yeah, we've got my double recording system.
Okay, on your little iPhone, love it.
I loved how we just had this long conversation about passwords and paranoia, and now we've got like two recorders going at once.
Yeah, well, you know, we're both Jewish, right?
Jewish alcoholics.
Yes, lots of paranoia going on
there. There's lots of paranoia. I did a lot of cocaine. I think I still have residual paranoia left over from that. Did you?
I did. I never got paranoia from cocaine. I got a lot of paranoia from marijuana.
Oh, I did that too. Okay, first of all, I'm self-conscious because I have these crazy marks from,
Were you cupped?
I was cupped.
Okay. I didn't know if you had an abusive boyfriend or you were cupped. When I saw those, I was like, someone's beating you.
Yeah.
Or you were cupped. Either one, I'm not going to ask.
I'm glad that you know. Do you think that asking about the cupping is more invasive than asking about the abusive
boyfriend? I think it's weirder, honestly.
It's really crazy. If I showed you my whole back, you'd like call the cops. Pretty much. It's bad. I'm just going to show you.
Show me.
I know this is not good for listeners.
Because the cops love to come here. Wow. That's like a crazy Art Deco like wallpaper print. I actually kind of like, I want to take a picture of it.
Do you want to use it and put it on your bedroom wall?
I do. It's really cute, actually.
It is kind of cute. Well, what's funny is that the acupuncturist or the cupper, both, he's the same man.
Is he abusive? Your abusive boyfriend is a cupper?
My boyfriend. he's like, do you want a picture of this? So he took the pictures
And, oh my God, I just totally lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah, yeah. And so the one of my back, I was like, oh my God. But really what I was reacting to is that I could see back fat. And then he took one of my neck. And, like, my neck looked so thin. And, like, my hair looked really kind of cute up in the ponytail. So I tweeted that one. Like, oh, it really didn't have to do with the big red welts. It had to do with that I saw back fat.
Well, because the truth is that if you tweeted that, there would be one Twitter asshole that was like, what's up with her love handles? And that would shatter your whole world for, like, a month.
Yeah, so. I wouldn't know because I would never allow an image that I didn't feel was 100% perfect to get out there.
Right.
So I do kind of want to go off on this tangent about social media and alcoholism. Mm-hmm. Do you find Twitter, like, the best and worst thing for an alcoholic who is possibly seeking constant validation at every turn?
Actually, I am very comfortable with Twitter. What I am not at all comfortable with is Facebook. I have a constant battle with Facebook. See, Twitter is perfect as an alcoholic because I am just putting out. It's just me.
Yeah.
I put out. I don't get... Yeah, sure, sometimes I have expectations of a retweet or something like that. But for the most part, I can tweet all day long. Nobody could say anything. And I can still be okay. The story doesn't get crazy in my head.
Facebook
is a fucking disaster.
Right, with the stories you make up about other people's lives being better than yours.
Which, you know, they're making it up. I'm just reading it. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not someone who just looks at pictures.
You add a little to the story about, oh my God, we're just so happy and look at our perfect child.
Of course. I mean, well, of course. Who doesn't? But I'm a little bit different when I see people married with children. I feel really bad for them.
Yeah,
I'm like, you're trapped. I am sorry you made that mistake. But it's more like, you know, career stuff and
the boasting on social media is a very delicate art.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That people rape constantly. I don't know. There's no one that does it right. You can't do it right. The only way you can boast on social media is if either someone does it for you.
Okay.
Or you're sending a link to something that you did.
Yeah.
With nothing, don't say anything. And, like,
interesting.
For instance, Amy Dresner, who just wrote something for you.
Good, let's make an After Party Chat reference. I always forget to plug
afterpartychat.com.
Which you were just saying is the best website you've ever seen in your entire
absolutely
life.
Absolutely. I read it all the time. It's how I get updated on everything After Party. Amy Dresner, very funny comedian, wrote a piece for you on that. And she tweeted, check out this article I just wrote. Perfect.
Right, perfect.
Not like, you know, just completely, here's the facts, check it out if you want to, if you don't.
Right.
The people who are, like, writing, that's the other thing about Twitter is it's that small amount of characters and a link.
Yeah.
Facebook people are like, okay, so 7.5 years ago when I moved to LA, I loved Tom Cruise. And it goes into this whole long thing about how they ran into him at Trader Joe's and now they're going to be an extra in his new movie. I can't.
But that stuff doesn't make you crazy. It makes you annoyed that you know them.
Yes, but it also does a little bit make me crazy because what I hear in that post is hope. And I don't, and I'm very triggered by hope. I'm very triggered by positive people who still have a positive outlook on, like, and have life and, like, have hope that, like, things are going to come together.
Wait, pathetic hope or any kind of hope?
Really, at this point, any kind of hope? because keep hope to yourself. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, that's how I feel about social media. It's like, look, if you've got hope, great, but don't throw it in other people's faces. Not in this economy.
Right,
you know?
Right, right. When did you start feeling that way?
probably about 6 years ago, I would say.
Uh-huh.
Some of it has to do with stand-up comedy.
Right.
Some of it has to do with, you know, interestingly enough, I started doing stand-up and got sober at the exact same time.
Uh-huh.
So
you don't know which
one. I don't know exactly. I don't know what, if it's where I am in my recovery.
Right.
Or if it is stand-up, or it's probably both.
Well, here's an optimistic challenge to what you're saying. You know, some of it, I think, I don't know how old you are, and we're ladies, so we don't even
26.
You don't look a day over 23.
Thank you so much.
But
26. I don't know what year that is born, but let's...
But I just looked at your license, and it's 100% true.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah. So, but I was lying out by a pool, because all I do is really glamorous things, like lying out by pools, and I don't get abused by acupuncturists, because I work 15 hours a day. And my friend and I are a certain age, and the other people around the pool were younger, were considerably younger. We're in, like, a just-landed-in-Hollywood kind of age.
I can't.
And... She was so triggered by their, oh my God, I sold a pitch and this looks like this and all of that. And I thought it was just so interesting, not so much that hope was gone, but that there was a time where I really was young enough to believe that that was the answer to everything, that selling that pitch was going to make me happy, that that meant so much, that I needed to tell everybody that that was like the main thing in my life. Mm-hmm. When it's not, when I get it, that like as soon as I get whatever that thing is, I just want something else anyway.
Right. And then also a lot of those things don't really lead to anything anyway.
No.
But, you know, I get triggered by that stuff all the time, too, now. And that's only in the last couple of years. Really only the last year, hardcore. And it's probably something having to do with my age, which is 26.
Right.
But
you're the only 26-year-old to ever be triggered by
Right, age. Right. Yes. I'm triggered by people my own age.
Yeah.
No, but the... what I go through is that, unfortunately, here's a truth. Mm-hmm. That Hollywood and people in general, but definitely in this city and this industry, there is a huge weight on age.
Oh, yes.
Huge weight on age. And to the point where there's a comedian, I'm not going to say her name, but she looks like she's in her mid-40s, but she is actually in her late 20s.
Oh.
Or she's actually, I think she just turned 30. Mm-hmm. But she does not look like that.
Yeah.
And it's better. And I... am older than
right.
I look.
And could honestly, jokes aside, could pass for any age. I mean, you
right.
could tell me you were 25, you could
right.
tell me
I could tell you I was 26, and you'd believe me. but, okay, maybe that's pushing it. But the point is that it's better for her to actually be 29 and look 45 than to be 45 and look 29.
Why?
I don't know. It has something to do with... just long. I don't know really what the real thing is. I'm still
You're
piecing
making
it together.
This is like a theory you've made up, though. You don't.
Yeah. I mean, there isn't a guidebook to the
right.
entertainment industry, but
right.
this is after many different observations
okay.
of because the most valuable comedian, the most valuable, the person that's going to make it. By the way, if anyone wants to be a stand-up comedian, here's a tip. If you are 20 mm-hmm. to 20, if you're 18 to 24, mm-hmm. You will make it if you can get on stage
right,
and do it.
Because it just takes longevity.
Basically. Yeah, and not even longevity, it's just, there's somebody I know that started, moved here at 22, 21.
Right.
Really never did stand-up comedy, started doing open mics within a year, was signed at Brillstein Gray, and had a deal.
But that person
MTV.
Was really funny, I would imagine.
No, everybody. Not funny at all. No,
okay.
No, not funny at all.
Okay.
Yeah, didn't even chance to be funny.
Right.
I'm not saying that she couldn't eventually be funny in the
right.
future, although
right.
now it's been like 4 or 5 years and there's still no real glimmer of hope happening, but... She's had every opportunity. She's got passed at, you know, different
right.
clubs and stuff like that.
Right.
But it's because of her age. And it's because she's marketable because we don't... She's really an actress. I mean, they're looking at her as an actress who can do stand-up comedy. She's
right.
getting visibility because of the stage time. But they're going, oh my God, here's somebody who's 21
right.
and can play 14 or whatever.
Right.
So
right.
my point is that... You know, they're mutually exclusive things like acting and stand-up comedy, but they end up getting meshed together where
mm-hmm.
somebody's, you know, career as a stand-up comic, I just did air quotes,
yeah.
is, you know, is sort of marked by what they book as an actor because they're a certain age, if
right.
that makes sense.
So right.
this is a bunch of mishmash, but my point is that age is very important. And
yeah.
so when I look at those young girls,
yeah.
I go, the truth is... Because I got hit on here's another thing that I know. I got hit on a lot in my 20s.
Right.
And I look so much better now.
Right.
I'm thinner.
Right.
I have straight teeth.
Right.
I'm confident. I mean, I look at pictures.
Right.
It's horrifying.
Right, right, right.
In fact, I wish I could show, but I have a picture
Wait,
of my license.
Post it.
We can, because
okay.
I didn't put you can't see that I'm actually 26 on that. But there's a picture of my license picture when I moved here.
Right. Well, license pictures are never really representative of anything.
But you're saying, can tell. Right. You can see.
The relative hotness.
Yes. And I was a lot hotter now, but I got hit on way more.
Okay. That is the exact same thing. I was literally 30 pounds heavier, had frizzy Jewish, half frizzy hair, was drunk all the time,
yep.
Chain smoked, and hit on constantly, and it's like rarer, so much rarer today. But I think what that has to do with, it's kind of like the newcomer in a program. It's just that I looked willing and dumb. It wasn't that I looked more appealing.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to believe that. And maybe that's what it is. And if there's any guys out there that can help explain this, because...
Well, you're not intimidating when you're a drunk, overweight girl.
Right. Yeah, that's true. But I guess maybe there is that theory of people, fives get hit on more than eights.
Right.
Because it's a, you know, lower hanging fruit, perhaps.
Right.
But God, I mean, I don't know that was it, because I was still really cute. I don't think I was a five. I was out of shape.
Right.
Yeah, and I had a huge drinking problem. I mean, I guess I was very easy, okay?
Yeah,
Let's be honest. I had easy written all over me.
I just think, because I experienced the same phenomenon.
But I'm still easy now. That's the thing. I'm like easier.
They don't know that.
I know.
That's what we're going to change with this podcast.
I was a condom Nazi in my 20s. I'll barely let a guy wear one now.
You're like,
are you listening?
Impregnate me. No, but you don't want to be impregnated.
No, I don't at all.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't. That's not. I feel that I have this feeling that I can't get pregnant.
Right.
Which isn't true.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's a dysfunction I have.
You just don't want it. I mean, is that a dysfunction? I mean, I think that might be nice to just clearly know that you don't want to.
Oh, I definitely don't want kids.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that I don't want to be pregnant.
Yeah.
I don't want to have a child, yet I'm not using protection regularly. So basically what I'm saying is I can't wait to get an abortion. That's really what I'm saying. And that's a horrible thing to even... But I'm not thinking about it.
No, but maybe what you're saying is... Well, so you have a sex life. That's exciting.
I have an active sex life.
Oh, God. Let's we're not getting into alcoholism, but this arguably could be more interesting. Active sex life consist of?
Right now, I'm going through... I was in a two-year relationship with an alcoholic who relapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a very codependent... Al-Anani kind of relationship.
I met him in
my regular life, but then I started dating him when he was was really solid in his 30 days of sobriety.
Right, nice.
And and then we broke up, and he relapsed after we broke up, but he was on his way head on to the relapse the last 6 months of our relationship. My point is that after I crawled out of that horrible thing, it sort of seemed to coincide with the beginning of my sexual peak, which 26. Is coming early at 26,
yeah.
But you know, some people develop earlier than others. So
nice.
I have just been, you know, wanting to have sex all the time. And it's different than when I was in my, I've always loved sex.
Yeah.
I've always been really, I don't want to say easy. I mean, I am easy. If I'm attracted to you, I'm super easy.
But you don't have shame around your sexuality, is what it sounds like.
No, not since I quit drinking. When I quit drinking, I did because I thought I did those things because I was drunk.
Right.
And then when I sobered up, I realized I'm just a whore. that's actually who I am as an authentic person. And then the shame was gone.
Right. Well, I think in all seriousness, I think that's really healthy that you, I think so many women do feel tons of shame around it and they feel like, oh my God, if I sleep with this guy, he's not going to respect, you know, they get caught up in all of that. Because that's societally what we're taught.
Yes, it is. And I somewhere along the line realized that if I'm not going to be able to check out with drugs and alcohol, then I'm going to enjoy this. I'm going to enjoy sex.
Are you able to quote unquote check out with sex?
Oh God, yeah. I have unhealthy sex, and then I have fine, it's healthy sex.
Okay, tell me the difference.
So I identify as a sex and love addict.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. Look at this.
Yes,
okay.
But I am not, I don't work that program anymore.
Right.
I used to, was actually my primary program.
I didn't know that predated the others.
It very shortly predated. I was in that program for about 3 months when I realized that if I didn't stop blacking out with alcohol, I wasn't going to be able to keep my bottom lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what they do in that program. But anyway, but the thing is, so I have every couple of years, so I get into a sex addicted relationship.
Okay.
I'm not really a love addict at all, actually.
Right.
And I don't know a lot of female sex addicts. I know they're out there, but they don't usually... I don't think
we know one in common.
Yes, I'm sure we do. Yes.
But yeah, no, it's true.
Right.
It's true.
So I get into a sex addicted relationship where I get what I like to lightly call dickmatized with somebody.
Uh-huh.
And then it usually is triggered because the guy is not as hot on me as I am on him. And then I go into the chase and I pursue it like I would pursue, like someone got me hooked on heroin and all of a sudden they're not calling me back.
Right.
You know,
right.
That happens like I'd say once every 3 or 4 years.
And then you get him. I assume you are successful in your pursuit.
Well, what happens is this is what's tricky about it. I'll have sex with someone and I won't realize that they're going to do that to
me. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And so I'm just casually having sex.
Here we go.
And then all of a sudden
they
I get hit.
Away.
Yeah, they pull away and I get hit with, for some reason, they're like the perfect cocktail of like emotionally unavailable and bad for me. And it's always like some kind of complicated thing, like they're my boss or they're married. Like it's always something like...
Right. That's where not simple.
It's not simple.
Right.
And I can check out so well on those because it's so distracting and encompassing.
Well, and it is just like cocaine. I mean, I've been in those where, and it's every text and you're in full on fantasy land and it is talk about like waking up the beast.
Yeah, that really wakes up the beast. That is... I don't feel sober during those times.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that I am. I'm not obviously in the other program, which is why I stopped doing it because I would do all of this work and then I would do my step work and I would feel really like I've got this. And then I would have a couple of healthy relationships, dating plans, which is the worst.
Right.
Two words should never go together.
Right.
And then I would like quote unquote relapse. And honestly, I enjoyed the relapse more than I enjoyed the 3 years that I spent trying to be healthy.
But, and it didn't have a very destructive impact on your life.
Of course it does, but it's short and it's worth it.
Right. Wow.
You know, I mean, at this point, I've been through it so many times now that I've sort of learned to control my drinking, so to speak, in a sense that I'll meet somebody and I can most of the time tell if they're going to be someone that's like that.
Right.
And sometimes I can peace out and like get out of it.
Yeah.
I cannot take the first drink. Sometimes the train has already left the station.
Right.
But if I recognize that it's that and the train's left the station, I just go with it. I go full on. I'm like, let's just bang, and then I'll deal with it.
Is it, because I relate to this to a degree. I mean, like, I had a certain kind of toxic man that I was, you know, routinely engaging with, and it was, but he was obvious from the start. He wasn't obvious from the start. My reaction was obvious from the start because I was immediately obsessive.
Mm-hmm.
And the men that I can date in a healthy way, I don't get immediately obsessive. I'm not checking my phone every second. I'm not convincing myself, because in therapy, I sort of realized what was behind that. For me, it wasn't really about the sex. It was more like this. I would convince myself, this is the last man on earth. And if this man does not love me, that's it. Dying alone. And it was, even though I would go, well, that doesn't make it, that's not accurate. Look, there's this guy here. Rational thought would not invade. Was it like, but it wasn't like that for you?
No, I get, well, it's evolved. I've been addicted to men for different reasons at different times. It really does also depend like where my head is at.
Right.
But in the last few times, it's really been about sex. I am addicted to high intensity, you know, if you were to watch a sex scene, there's a sex scene in a movie called Disclosure from the 80s with Demi Moore.
Oh, Michael
Douglas. She's like rapes him.
Yeah.
And I am addicted to sex scenes that feel like that looks.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay. So,
very high intense, slamming up against walls, blah, blah, blah.
Which
is only comes with built up tension, with like, you know, forbidden situations, you don't get that with someone you're dating.
Unless you're doing like role play, which you're probably not down with.
Which needs to have two people. Right. And like my friend Nina Manny says, a comedian Nina Manny, I don't like to role play because I don't need reminders of my failed fucking acting career. You know what I mean? Like I don't want to do that.
Right.
I like to create authentic dysfunction.
Yeah. Good for you.
And it also helped like the fantasy it helps with it. It's like, this guy, you know, is my boss. I mean, you know, the complicated things. It's just, but I got really hooked once. I was working in this office and, at this production company, there was this guy that worked there who was not cute. Mm-hmm. He was short. He was like a nerdy, not cute guy. Mm-hmm. And it was just when Instant Messenger had sort of come. Mm-hmm. I was in eighth grade. God. And we started instant messaging. And for some reason, I don't know how it transpired into this really highly intense thing where we had to pretend we were professional. He was around the other corner.
Right.
He had a girlfriend that he lived with.
Right.
And we ended up going into the supply closet, and he like ripped off my, and I have never had an orgasm that intense. And from that point on, I have not been able to shake that addiction.
Wow. When was that?
That was in 2001.
And that was just one time, or did that continue?
We engaged for a little while. Like, we probably hooked up, like, two or three times. But, he had a girlfriend, and I was confused by the whole thing. I was like, what is going on here? And then I ended up losing my job over it.
Oh.
Because I couldn't do work. Right. I was, like, frothing at the mouth, instant messengering him.
Right, right, right.
And then that transferred into being, like, a long, lifelong now, or adult lifelong life of us sexual text messaging that I'm addicted to, which is my biggest trigger.
Really?
Sexual text messaging
don't
is my
you
biggest
run
trigger.
Out of things to say?
Nope.
Really?
No, I don't.
Endless
I don't.
New material?
I mean, it depends how. Usually I'm so much more into it than they are.
Uh-huh.
Because the guys want to see.
Yeah.
We want to read hear and fantasize. They want to see. So it usually they'll give me a little bit before they want to graduate to real life or pictures or webcam or whatever.
Do you worry about these pictures getting out?
Well, I'll never send anything with my face on it.
Right.
So, no.
Right, right.
And quite frankly, I've never looked better, so I...
You're like, please circulate, please post.
Yeah, like, I'm very afraid at the age I'm at of aging. Like, I'm very afraid of, like, I'm starting to see some changes, and now I'm just taking pictures like crazy. Like, I don't know, show my grandkids. I have no idea.
Non-existent grandkids.
Yeah, like, show somebody...
Yeah.
Like, you know, so I don't know. It's very strange, but...
So where do you think this comes from? Not the picture taking.
No, of course. It comes from... You want to get deep, Anna?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. Let's do it. It comes from... I recently watched a special on the OWN Network called Daddyless Daughters, which was very... It was intense. It was great. Mm-hmm. But I really realized that something that I'm lacking in my own... self-love, there's a hole where a male loving non-sexual relationship is. And, so when I got into, I was very pretty as a young girl, I didn't know it, but I was very pretty. So I got attention from men very early on.
Right, right.
And so, I learned somewhere, I got the message that my value was in the way I looked.
Yeah.
And then in high school, I got, when you're a girl, as you know, and people don't like you, they call you a whore. That's whether you are or you're not.
Right, that's what they do.
So I went into a new school. Everybody hated
me
because I was Jewish.
I
grew up in Newton, Massachusetts.
Okay. And not a lot, no Jews. And
no, there was, but I went to a private Jewish school and then I begged my mother to put me into public high school because I wanted that, you know, John Hughes experience.
Right, right, right.
And that was a nightmare. I was new, I was Jewish, I was pretty, like, they hated me.
Right.
The girls. So I got terrorized, I got called a whore, I got, you know, all this kind of stuff. And because I got called a whore, guys thought I was a whore, and so I got all this attention.
Right.
And I somewhere learned to take control of that and go, okay, you know what, I'm going to take control of the sexuality. You're not going to, like, I got, you know.
Yeah.
So... It something mixed with my value is in how I look, and I'm taking control of my sexuality. Now I have something to offer.
Right.
So the core belief within me is I am worthy of nothing unless I'm offering you sex or drugs and alcohol. And I don't offer drugs and alcohol anymore.
Right.
So that's the core belief, and that's where it comes from. So when somebody is intently and violently, you know, cheating on their girlfriend, cheating on their wife, you know, blah, blah.
It translates to you so much.
Exactly. Yeah. It translates to I'm enough.
Right.
And
that's
about.
Right. But you're so knowledgeable
taking
about
the sexy
it.
About out of it.
No, but that's like...
There's a guy listening to this, like, jerking off and going, oh, God. No.
I like that you just did a jerk off.
Sorry, I did. Sitting. Sorry. And you blushed.
I'm still blushing. I don't actually believe I'm capable of blushing.
I don't blush either, yeah.
But it's interesting that you're so self-aware about it. And yet,
still in it, yeah. It does.
Do you do all the cognitive therapy?
Of course,
are you in therapy every week?
Yeah, I mean, I took a long break from it, right. But I am in it right now. Yeah.
And does it quote unquote improve this issue? Or what you said is that you like it. It's still working.
You know what? It's chipped away. The awareness has chipped away. What it does take out is the shame and the self-hatred and the beating myself up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't beat myself up about any of this shit anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, because it feels like a conscious decision. Mm-hmm, you know, sometimes, even when I'm in addiction, even when I know that something's happened and now I'm powerlessness, I accept my own powerlessness. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, well, this is who I am and I'm getting better. You know, when I start to do things that I can be somewhat, I'll sabotage my career, but stuff I don't like
with this kind of thing.
Yeah, sometimes like I get involved with people that will,
like a married comedian or something.
Yeah, I mean, well, that the truth is I've never actually been involved with a married man, but like there has been obsessions and pursuits with married men that have, you know, is that thing where my friends are constantly like, but he's married,
right,
you know what I mean, like you need to let it go, but I mean, like somebody who can offer me work or something like that. I've made a lot of messes.
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, things I can't do because of that, because I do like to shit where I eat. Like, because strangers don't interest me, really.
Right. Well, okay, so how long are you sober?
I'll be 10 in November.
You'll be 10 in November.
So nine months.
And tell me about, you're from Massachusetts, came out to LA.
To party.
Mm-hmm. And to become?
Nothing, really. I didn't figure out I wanted to do stand-up until I'd been here for 4 years.
What were you doing before that?
Waiting tables. You know what I wanted to do is I wanted to work in the entertainment industry in comedy because I loved comedy.
Yeah.
So I moved here. I got a job waitressing at the Laugh Factory.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, I'll just figure it out because I was like, you know, young. And that led to a lot of different jobs in comedy. I booked rooms. I assisted a comic. I worked in an agency. I worked in an agency for like 7 years repping comics. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere along that line, I realized I was miserable and I wanted to try stand-up myself. And so I did that sort of under the radar for a few years. When I realized that that's actually what was fulfilling me, I made the transition to like accepting myself as a comic, and that's where it's been since.
And then, when did you first start drinking?
I started drinking when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
Alcoholically from the get-go, just because my parents never drank at home. My dad was a drinker and a cocaine smoker.
What?
Yes.
Okay, tell me more.
So my dad is, my parents are both, I guess what you'd classify as hippies, but not really politically. They just, you know, they lived in Taos, New Mexico. They hitchhiked. They walked the earth. You know what I mean?
Right.
My mom, you know, did a lot of drugs. My mom used to live with Dennis Hopper, actually. She's had quite a life.
Okay.
And my dad, as well, he toured with Nina Simone, and he's had some success as a musician. But for the most part in my life, my parents have been struggling artists. My dad's a street musician to this day.
Okay.
He's never really earned an income.
Okay. How did they send you to private school?
My grandmother was wealthy. She's an upper middle class Jew.
Right.
And that's who we moved in with. That's where I was raised, in her house.
Oh, wow. So your parents, are you an only child?
No, I have a little brother.
So your parents were kind of like, were they quote unquote fun? Were they,
Well, my mother is extremely talented artist, and she was making her way in her career when she got pregnant with me. And immediately she was just one of those women. Then when she got pregnant, she was like, nope, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And she immediately moved from Taos, New Mexico, where she was like painting and making like turquoise jewelry.
Right.
And like moved my dad, to Massachusetts in with her mother.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was supposed to be temporary, but then my mom just, you know, she had her baby and she changed and she became a Jewish, you know, middle class or upper middle class mom.
Right.
And wanted to get me into Jew school and do the whole Jew thing. And we were very Jewish.
Right.
And my dad, meanwhile, is like probably sit around waiting going like,
what happened.
What happened here? Yeah. And he's, you know, not, you know, a little slow on the uptake, so it took him 11 years to figure it out. But he finally, like, left and moved to, back to California, where he's from. Mm-hmm. And he's been here since 88. And he just, you know, my dad lives in, like, a shack with no running water. He doesn't have any teeth. He smokes pot and, like, eats, like, stuff out of cans and, like, plays his guitar.
And he smokes cocaine.
He used to. So when we was living with us in Newton, and it was the 80s and people had money.
Yeah.
My dad basically would be home for a couple days and then go out to downtown Boston and play music on the street and freebase, because that's what people were doing in the 80s, and drink and, you know, fuck groupies. And, like, that's basically what he did, you know, from the time I was born, from 80 to, like, you know, 88. You know, well, I mean, I wasn't born in 80, obviously,
because
I'm,
yeah,
you know, 26. But, maybe, you know, whatever.
And do you have a relationship with him now?
I do. But I'm considering terminating.
Really?
Yeah, because I realized that my last serious boyfriend was him.
Right.
Was him, exactly. And I feel like I even though that relationship was very painful, I tolerated it and kept trying to fix it because it was my dad.
Right.
And I feel like if I'm going to allow him and my dad in my life, I'm going to continue to allow people like my ex in my life. And I
interesting. Don't do want you to do that. Think that, I mean, so your dad lives in a shack and eats out of whatever because mm-hmm. he's an addict, right? Or no. That's a life choice.
Yeah, my dad is, and this is what was sort of difficult for me to wrap my mind around addiction, because my mother has a knack for dating quote unquote functional drug addicts. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is it's not the stories you hear in the rooms, really.
Right.
It's not like I was homeless under a bridge. It's not, you know, my mom's husband after that was a crack addict. Mm-hmm. He would be fine for months at a time, and then he would get, like, a windfall of money, and he would go on a weekend crack binge, and my mom would go crazy, and then it would be over, and it would be fine again for another 6 months.
Right.
So that was sort of what I grew up with. And so, yeah, he doesn't, from what I understand, he doesn't have any money. He doesn't want, his main priority is not working. Mm-hmm. His main priority is playing his music, and that's all he wants to do. So it seems like pot is easy because you can grow it himself.
Right.
I think, you know, he drinks if he is given it to for free. I think he'll probably do blow if it's given to him for free, but, like, there's no money to do that stuff.
Right.
And an addict that I know, like, addicts that I know in the rooms in LA would figure fucking out how to go and get it.
Right.
But he's fine with that.
Yeah.
So it's like, is he an addict? I don't know. He's just lives at a very low level of life. But yeah, it's a choice.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't relate to every single thing in the rooms. You know, the people talk all the time. I procrastinate and I'm full of sloth. And I'm just like, oh. And I'll be like, oh, am I not an addict? I don't relate to that at all.
Right.
So just because he's not, I mean, granted, that's a bigger deal, not going and chasing down drugs. But it still sounds like addiction.
To me, it does to me, because he sacrificed
everything.
I mean, look, there's a thought that every human wants to, you know, be involved in their kids' lives and be a parent, but I don't think that's true. So it's hard for me to say he sacrificed.
I think
mothers maybe,
yeah.
But not even, you know, it's like,
not always.
Right.
But
mostly.
Yeah.
But my dad, yeah, I mean, my dad's number one priority is music. Mm-hmm. And nothing's going to fuck with that. Nothing's ever fucked with that. And I think that the drugs and the booze and whatever goes along with that, and if for some weird universe it didn't, my thought is he wouldn't do it.
Right.
I really feel like that.
So you started using drugs when?
Probably 16. I started smoking pot fairly regularly.
I'm gonna do something weird. It's just because my neck
no.
kind of
Go
hurts.
Ahead.
And this doesn't. I'm just sort of
no
like
problem.
Lying
no,
down
no, no.
and doing a weird stretch. I'm gonna move the microphone closer to you.
But I really kind of took off. You know, I tried Coke and I did all this, but when I started working in the bar industry when I was like 20, mm-hmm. Ecstasy was big, mm-hmm. and you know, I mean, I smoked tons of pot through high school and early college, but when I started working in the bar industry, I got heavy into coke and ecstasy. But drugs never took me down. I mean, drugs was something I did, but alcohol is my problem.
And so, what caused you to get sober?
A general, what I know now to be a spiritual illness, a spiritual bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. But what it felt like at the time was debilitating depression. Mm-hmm. And the alcohol wasn't quieting it anymore.
Right.
You know, it wasn't solving it. I could no longer live. It used to be that my life was miserable during the day when I was sober, and then I would live to go out at night
right.
and
That's
party.
That's so interesting, yeah, and then that stopped.
And then it stopped being enough.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just miserable, and I didn't, you know, some people, when they're in that position, have the opportunity to go with their heroin addict friends and go in that direction, or go with their coke addict friends.
Right.
I just had I was working at a production company, and I just worked with a bunch of other, you know, 20-year-old, you know, people in their 20s who like to party.
Right.
And so there wasn't really an opportunity to go off with those drug addict friends, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, but like you said with your dad, I feel like you might have found them if you were meant to.
I guess. You know? Yeah, I mean, I wasn't ever really looking for that. I was never looking. Like, I looked to be a cigarette addict. Like, I sought it out.
Yeah.
I sought it out. I sought out being a drinker. I sought out being a pot smoker. I sought out ecstasy. I even sought out cocaine, but I never... Heroin, crack, speed, none of those things ever interested me. I didn't find those addictions to be glamorous.
Right, right, right.
But I did find the other stuff to be glamorous.
And so you, were you suicidal? Like how did
Yeah.
And so you said, did you know sober people?
No, I didn't. I had gotten prescribed Prozac, and it made me manic, mainly because I drank on it. Mm. But so I spent this whole summer just acting crazy. I mean, I was drinking 3 times as much as I used to, and then I was, like, hooking up with people. I was picking people up off the street.
Wow.
I mean, I was going... It was, like, crazy. So the wreckage, the on-paper wreckage was extremely clear of what was happening. And that was 2002.
Right.
So I didn't get sober for another, like, little over a year. But from that point, it just started to be, like, incomprehensible demoralization from that point on.
Right,
I finally got off the meds in, like, April of 2003... on my own.
Okay.
So I probably went into some sort of like post antidepressant depression.
Yeah.
But I couldn't figure out the right combo. It was like going out to bars was causing too much of like I would wake up with like someone I didn't know and like Taco Bell sauce all over my face.
Right.
Like there was too much weirdness with that.
Right.
And then when I drank at home, it was like I would wake up on the floor with like a call log on my cell phone that like I couldn't even deal with.
Right.
You know, like it just kept being...
Yeah, you couldn't stop yourself from doing shit.
It was getting very unmanageable.
Right.
And, this is actually... I always forget about this. I moved... A friend of mine from high school... who actually was, like, my arch enemy in high school. Mm-hmm. This guy, we actually got in, like, physical fights and stuff in high school, but he was, like, the only person I knew that had lived out here also in LA. And so for some reason we had become friendly after all those years going by, and it was like, you're the only Newton person I know out here. He developed a crystal meth addiction and needed a place to stay. And in my, you know, dormant Al-Anon things, I was like, oh... Let's have closure on our lifelong hatred and you come in and live with me. So he was supposed to stay with me for a weekend while he figured it out, and he stayed with me for 6 months. But when he moved in, I wasn't sober. And he was dealing with his crystal meth addiction through drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so we fucking drank.
Right.
I mean, we drank. And there was no real unmanageability because... we were home,
right?
And it was just me and him.
And both of you were going to black out.
And we just passed out, and we called it a day. And then I met a guy who was normal, and I started to bring that behavior, that home behavior, into the relationship.
Right.
And the mirror of him, his like reaction of like, you just drank 2 bottles of wine on your own, and now it's 4 a.m. and you're drunk dialing me.
Right.
Was not flying.
Right.
With this normal guy. And I had, a moment of clarity where I went, if I want something normal, then I've got to figure something out. And that's when I don't know. I ended up calling this girl who I hadn't talked to in a while. I think I was just calling everybody because I'd lost touch with all my normal friends.
Right.
And I called this girl that I hadn't talked to in about a year, and she was going to AA. And I was like, I'll go with you.
Uh-huh. Did you call her because you thought she might be getting sober?
No, I called her because I think I was calling a bunch of just people who used to know me before I went off the deep end.
Right.
You know, people who I used to have, you know, like old friends, basically. Right. And when I mean, at the time I was 20, really early 20s. So old friends was like somebody I hadn't talked to in a year.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I hadn't, and she just happened to be going to AA, and it was like a god shot. I was like, okay.
And you just started going, and you just got sober?
I started going. I didn't quit drinking immediately, but then I decided to go for 30 days, and I remember feeling so much better after 30 days, and so I decided to go for 60 days. And it just was one of those things, like, it just felt right.
Right.
It felt like what I needed. It just felt, I hated the program, I hated the people, mm-hmm. I didn't like it, but being sober felt like, okay, yeah, because I stopped having the debilitating depression and, like, unmanageable anxiety.
Right, you know? Right. And when did you stop hating the program and the people, or has that not yet?
No, that happened. That happened in 2009 when I had, like, 5.5 years of sobriety. I hadn't been going to meetings for years. I mean, really, irregularly. I didn't have a home group. I wasn't in touch with the program for years. And I hit a bottom, like a gnarly suicidal bottom.
Right.
And I decided, I mean, it lasted, you know, like 8 months. Mm. But at the end of it, I decided that I was going to kill myself or I was going to go back to AA. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think it was alcoholism. I really didn't. Right. I was just like, I thought it was just my career. And I was like, I'll go to AA and, like, so I have some place to go.
Right.
And I went there for 30 days, like, every day. And at the end of the 30 days, I was like, oh, right. I'm an alcoholic.
Right.
And this is my medication.
Right.
And that's when I recommitted, and I have been full on, like, I try to go to a meeting every day. I go to 5 meetings a week, for sure.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And do you, like, pray? Do you?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Not a regular regimen, because I never got into get up, make my bed, pray. Yeah. I never got into that.
Yeah.
But I do, when I feel scared, which is usually several times a day, I do pray. I do my third step prayer. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm drowning in resentments.
Yeah. You'll write about them? And.
Sometimes when I'm feeling, it changes the things that I do. I do just enough that works. Yeah. And then if it doesn't work, I go deeper.
Right,
but,
right.
A lot of times I'll pray for, you know, I try to pray for the people that I,
the girl who's not funny, but,
right. Oh yeah. I've prayed for her a lot. Although, you know, the danger of praying for somebody, because what I have found in the entertainment industry is the people who are not nice to people, who are very dysfunctional, who are still using, are the ones that make it, right? And I had a conversation once with this guy who was a dry drunk, and he goes, Danielle, show me one comedian who is sober, who is on top of their game. Show me one. Now, right now, I can show you one.
Yeah.
But at the time, there wasn't. This was actually right after Greg Giraldo died.
Right.
And he was totally right. Everybody that was kicking ass, that was really, like, doing it, were all pretty much either addicts or miserable comics. And that's the truth. The truth is that the people who are willing to step on other people, the people who don't care at all about humanity or don't care all about themselves and are willing to run themselves ragged doing 17 different things, those are the people that get ahead, that are going to do it. But I'm okay with that now because I can't live that way.
Right.
So I'm okay with, I've realized my goal in life has switched from wanting to be a successful stand-up comic to wanting to be happy.
Yeah. I mean, because that's the thing. It's like, I know some, you know, horrible. I like some very successful actors who are horrible. And I know some very successful actors that are not horrible at all, that are nicer, like movie stars who are nicer than average people. So, I mean, I hear you that super dysfunctional type, that type that is not going to stop, that is, you know, I think that they are so, that type of personality is so sick with that belief that getting fame and on top is actually what's going to, you know, heal what ails them. And that's just, they're setting themselves up for a huge, horrible.
Or they're not. But what they do, what happens to those people that we don't know about, that I believe happens to them. I've seen some of it, and we hear about some of it, I guess, is that they're miserable once they get. It's like what you said when I thought that pitch was going to heal me or save me or whatever. Yeah. And they're miserable. And, you know, quite frankly, grass is always greener. Would I rather be miserable with a long resume? Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure.
No, you
but,
wouldn't.
Well, I wouldn't now. But there is something. It goes back to what we originally started talking about, which is, you know, my biggest struggle is always going to be self-worth.
Right.
I don't think I'll ever really fully heal from that. I get in better places. But it does suck when you're standing next to somebody who might be miserable in their life, but they've accomplished things, and a neutral party, and it's like they put more value on that person because they've had those guest stars or whatever, and they don't put any value on the fact that I've spent most of my life in therapy, have worked the 12 steps several times, I'm good to my friends. That has no value. Like, I meet a lot, as a female comic, you meet a lot of people, and when they find out you're a female comic, everyone wants to talk about comedy, which is the worst thing in the world.
Right.
Especially female comedy, and it's like, for a period of time, it was like, what do you think about Chelsea Handler? And then it was, what do you think about Whitney Cummings? And right now it's, oh, I love that Amy Schumer. And it's like a knife that goes into your gut, because it's like, yeah, they're great. But, you know, I don't want to talk about their sets and their lives and their whatever. It's like, good for them. Great.
Right.
You know? But it does have the thing of, no matter what I do, and then it goes back to the dad thing, no matter what I do,
It's not enough.
They won't notice. They only notice if there's these things.
Right.
So how can I not feel like that's what's going to make me complete?
Well, I guess our goal, and I mean, I'm saying this as much to me as I am to you, is with all this work that we do in recovery and therapy, is to not give a shit what they think, and what easier said than done. You know?
I don't know that that will ever happen, but what I have had success with is I no longer care if that happens for me. And I do care. It's always going to hurt when somebody who has no significance in my life or whatever puts more value, gives more power to somebody who's done things that, you know, that's always going to hurt me, because my ego is my ego.
Right.
But what those are moments in time that I'm up against versus like my day-to-day, everyday life.
Right.
And I accept that I am only willing to do what I'm willing to do, and that I accept that I'm not... I could get farther if I did X, Y, and Z, but I'm not going to do X, Y, and Z, and I don't shit all over myself about it.
Right. Well, but okay, that being said, you perform in Vegas all the time.
I have, yes.
Okay, so talk to me about what you're doing.
Well, I used to perform in Vegas somewhat regularly at a show that's no longer around.
Mm-hmm.
At the Palms, it was called the Playboy Comedy Shows. That's not around anymore. But like every now and then, like there'll be a stand-up comedy show that I'll go out to Vegas and do. I just did a corporate event there. I do the road, not as much as I used to, but I do, and I do stand up, you know, somewhat regularly, but right now I'm, for the last, like, while, it's been a while, I've just sort of been living my life, and, I won't say no to gigs, and I don't say no to stuff, but I don't have, like, people are like, what do you want, and I just can't answer that question anymore.
Right.
You know, I may be able to, but right now I'm in this, like, downswing where I'm focused on my program.
Right.
And what I really want is just to be creatively fulfilled and be happy and be able to pay my bills.
Right.
And I don't really know that's whatever those things are. You know, I've been trying things out, and last year I took, like, a regular job, like a marketing job.
Oh, really?
That was a disaster.
Okay.
But, you know, I made some good money for a chunk of time, and then I left. But I learned through that experience that, oh, no, it has to be...
On your terms.
It has to be a freelance, I freelance right, and, like, that is a good supplemental income. Like, I have a lot of multiple streams of income that sort of keep me afloat. It is no retirement plan, it is no...
Right.
But... For the last couple of years...
What do you write for?
I do copywriting.
Okay, nice.
I do art department stuff, copy for art department stuff. I've done very minimally article writing, but that's what I should be doing more of. But for the most part, I do, like, newsletters and press releases and stuff for...
Pays better, I'm sure.
Sure. But it's
soul
like
cleaning.
Pulling teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I would rather sell my soul, quote unquote, to that.
Than in an office.
Than,
breathing other people's air all day long.
And the truth is I could start writing some articles and start submitting them. I don't do that because I have been in a lockdown. Like, I'm coming out of it.
Right.
I'm starting to get... But I used to spend, like, 5 to 6 hours of my career every day administratively, and that just raises my expectations to a level I can't handle.
Right. You mean you would send out...
Oh, I would get up in the morning, I would write for a couple of hours, then I would email my manager, I would stay on top of this, I would go on my website, I would update my... I mean, I was constantly booking dates in town to put on my website, and blogging. Right. I mean, I was crazy, and... While it felt really good in a way,
yeah,
I always like compare it to like juicing kale. Like when you juice kale, it's like, yeah, you'll have to juice a lot of kale and you'll get some juice and eventually have a shot of kale and it's really good for you.
Right.
But it's not like you're holding a riffraff bag of like unjuiceable kale.
Right.
And that is just what it was like. I mean.
Right, right.
So the fruits that I am enjoying today in my stand-up career have to do with all of that work that I did.
Right.
So there, it's not nothing.
But if you didn't enjoy, if the doing of the work made you too insane, then it's not worth
it. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I have to bring it down. I can't do no work.
Yeah.
Because then I may as well just quit.
Right.
But it has to be very minimal. I am willing now to, it's not even an hours thing. It used to be, because I read The War of Art. I
never
love
read
that book.
Yeah,
oh my God,
it's love it.
So great.
Yeah.
And I lived by that for a long time. I can't do that anymore. So what I do is I make a to-do list and I give myself two business-related things, like two emails or two things I need to do, and I get those done.
Right.
And that's where I'm at right now.
That seems reasonable. I like that. I make a to-do list that is totally undoable.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I've gotten out of that because that's I struggle with perfectionism, and that's been something I've had to. So I'll make a. I have a running to do, and then I take off that running to do, and I make a daily to do.
Right, right, right.
And then there's always like three things I absolutely have to do. I mean, I even put like gym meeting on there, so I feel like I've done stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's like you know, there's usually two emails I need to send out. One's totally directly career related. One's just like maybe self care related.
Right.
I keep it really small. Because if I don't do anything at all.
But that's good. And it's also, you don't have these massive welts on your back that, like, I have as a result of
stress. Is that stress related?
Well, it's like 10 hours at the computer every day.
Oh.
Every day. But
you're a writer.
Yeah. So that's where I have to be.
Right.
But I work very much on having balance.
Yeah.
You know, that's constantly, like my thing is, like, if I talk to my mom and I'm like, oh, I'm taking the day off, she's like, oh my God, good for you. It's like the opposite
of a Jewish mother. That's amazing.
She's just like, and it's always just like, you work too much, and yeah.
There's, you know what, I come from a non-working family, so I was like that as well, and it took me a long time to realize that there's no fucking, I'm not getting an award.
I know.
I'm not getting a thing.
I like it, though. See, the thing is, I do enjoy it.
I enjoy parts of it, but I realized that I was having expectations.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think that's really self-aware, that you're just setting yourself up. You know, the thing that I am always striving for, too, is around that, is how do I have hope without setting myself up for disappointment or resentment?
What I have found is I don't dabble in hope. Hope to me is like near beer.
We're going full circle.
Yeah, hope to me is like near beer.
Interesting,
interesting. I have to be in faith only. Okay. I can't get into hope. Okay. And that's why I get very triggered by hearing people talking about their screenplays and blah, blah, blah. Because, there's all these, like, things they say about L.A., like, oh, blah, blah, like, these people are talking about their screenplays. But really what people are bothered by is that these people actually think that this means something.
It's their delusion that bothers them.
Right.
Yeah.
But these people, I mean, yeah, there are some sick people who are literally making up that they wrote a screenplay and they haven't. But most of the people actually have done that. They actually have emailed it to an agent that will never read it.
Right.
But the hope that they're keeping alive is very threatening because we're not able... Yeah.
Because it reminds you of you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or it reminds me of either something I used to have or something that's beaten out of me or something I wish I still had.
Well, but I think that's different. I mean, when I see people that... You know, the people who are talking about the things that are happening in their career are often my most successful people I know
don't talk about
what's going on in their careers. And it's the people that are trying to keep the dream alive and just like, oh my God, I work so hard. I can't make it to that, says the person who like, doesn't ever work, you know?
Right. Yeah, I can't.
Or the person.
Resume givers. I can't and I won't.
Yeah.
I can and I want. And you're right. I mean, when things are really cracking,
yeah.
I don't want to talk about it because, one, I don't want to jinx it. And two, I know that not everybody's in that place. And I know what it feels like when someone tells me.
Yeah.
You know, obviously I'll tell my really good friends.
Right.
But I'm not going to go around being like, just got a comedy special. Like, right. I'm not going to do, you know.
Right. Right. And even those people in meetings who will sort of share stuff, you know, like, it's just, it's so clear when somebody wants just to get attention for that. And it seems sad, you know. Yeah. And I really, and I think it's sad because I want validation. Like, I'm going, yeah, I want people to be like, what do you mean you're sight? And oh my God, you know, and I totally want that reassurance, which is why.
We hate it.
Yes.
And we see it in other people.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
of course.
Okay, you're fantastic. This has been so good. And now we have to do the question from Twitter, which I don't actually have in front of me, but I do have it in front of me. It's from Mark Desjardins.
Uh-huh. French. Love it.
And he was asking about Subutex, and then I was telling you when I walked in here about how the situation is now shilling for Suboxone.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of asked if you had any opinions on, and these are opiate replacement drugs,
right.
For anybody who...
You know, it's interesting. When I came, when I first came into AA, when I came back into AA in 2009, I was going to a meeting that had a lot of ex-heroin addicts on it that were all on Suboxone. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, I'm not an opiate addict, I never had that problem, so I didn't know what Suboxone was.
Right.
I just knew that it wasn't methadone, and I it's very known that methadone is a drug on its own.
Yeah.
And that, yes, while it helps you, it's also a drug on its own.
Right.
I thought, I had heard that Suboxone was, you know, comparable to like an antidepressant.
Right.
Where you take it and it really just keeps you from being dope sick and keeps the cravings away.
Right.
What I've recently learned is that isn't the case.
No.
And that it's actually an opiate in itself.
Yeah.
And it's a drug in itself. So my opinion about it is that if you're taking Suboxone, you cannot say you are sober.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion about it. It doesn't mean you can't be in the rooms. It doesn't mean you can't start working on your recovery.
Right.
But I don't think that you can include that in your time.
Right.
If it does. However, let me just say this. I wouldn't sponsor someone that was on Suboxone.
Yeah,
and mainly because I don't have any experience with it.
Right.
But I'm on antidepressants.
Right,
and if I were to start getting panic attacks and someone were to prescribe me Klonopin, I would take it as prescribed.
Right.
That would be the thought. So if somebody's taking Suboxone as prescribed for a period of time to get off of heroin because that's what they're under a doctor's care, that's one thing.
Right.
But if that's not a solution...
Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, I just think it's dangerous that it's considered, there's no exit strategy. It's just considered a long-term plan. You're just going to stay on this. And that they, you know, that they get people to go around saying, I'm sober and I'm on Suboxone. And that's just like spreading that to a huge, you know, people, the public misunderstands addiction so much already. And it's just confusing and muddying the waters more.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've never been on Suboxone. I know lots of people who have, and apparently the detox is worse than the detox for anything else.
That's what I've heard also.
Yeah.
I've also heard that as well, which is actually how I found out that it was, which made me realize, like, you know, I don't have any hard and fast opinions about, you know, things that affect you above the neck or blah, blah, blah. But you're in AA, it's a spiritual program and you're supposed to connect to a higher power. And the more things that you do that cut you off, there are things that cut you off from that higher power. And then there's things that open you up.
Right.
And I do feel like psychotropics, allow you to
feel normal.
To feel normal so that you can connect to a higher power and get into your program. If you're having panic attacks, that's a medicine that's as needed.
Right.
You know, I have no opinion on that.
Right.
And which is why I don't, you know, it's hard for me to say about the Suboxone, but I do feel like if there's an exit strategy, then I mean, people go into detox and they're on Xanax and whatever. But I also feel like, why not just start your time over?
Right. I mean, I think this will be debated increasingly, you know, more and more. Because when I got sober in rehab, I mean, I wasn't I did like opiates, but I wasn't an opiate, whatever, that wasn't my main thing. I guess they were putting people on Suboxone, but it wasn't the way it is now.
Yeah.
But, okay, transitioning out, people can find you online and your website that apparently you never update anymore.
Yes, yeah, I just updated it, actually. My website is DanielleStewart.com, and that's DanielleStewart. And then I'm on Twitter at TheDannyStew, and that's DanielleStew.
And it's funny, and not always safe for work, not always.
Mm-mm.
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time, but not always.
Yeah, not always.
But very funny.
Yes, thank you very much.
As you are. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.